Gay Mormon Stories is a production of Mormon Stories and the Open Stories Foundation. To support this podcast, please donate today at gaymormonstories.org. All donations go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer Mormons. And thanks for listening.
Hi, this is Daniel Parkinson. Today we are doing our next segment of Gay Mormon Stories, and I'm really excited to do today's episode because I feel like we've been first neglecting the women and the lesbian community in our podcast, and this will help correct that a little bit. And what's also really nice is that this time we get to interview a lesbian couple who's in a committed relationship. And that gives us an opportunity to present their story and understand their experience in the context of one of them growing up Mormon and the other one also growing up in another relatively strict Christian religious background. So today we have Karen Hendricks and Tanya Smith. Karen happens to be the spiritual director at Affirmation, so she is well known to many of you. She also did Tanya actually and Karen were principal in a podcast done a few weeks ago through Affirmation that I also posted on Gay Mormon Stories that you should all listen, where they also spoke with Sam Noble, Carolyn Pearson, and Judy Finch. It was amazing. You all have to go listen to it if you haven't yet. Tanya modified that discussion, and we might even get into some of those same issues here on this podcast. So I'm going to ask you guys to give us a super brief introduction. I don't want to repeat things that we're going to talk about later, but just to get an idea who you are and where you are. So can each of you say hi and a very tiny introduction?
Do you want me to start, Tanya?
Sure, go ahead.
I am Karen Hendricks, and I grew up in the beautiful Logan, Utah. And I, as Daniel said, am the spiritual director for Affirmation and am no longer a practicing member of the LDS Church, but have continued a great love for the church and the people and have expanded spiritually to other paths, but still have an appreciation for the church and for people I consider still to be my people.
Yeah. And Tanya.
Yes, I did not grow up in the LDS Church, but I grew up in a small church called the Church of the Brethren, which is a peace church similar to the Mennonites. And I grew up in Ohio. The Church of the Brethren is a Protestant religion. It's Anabaptist roots in Europe. And my particular congregation was fairly conservative, and I am no longer a member of that particular church, and I'm also, like Karen said, pursuing other spiritual paths, but spirituality is very important to me, and I appreciate all that I learn from diverse people and all of the different perspectives of the journey.
Okay, well, thank you, Tanya. Well, I'd like to ask you then, each of you one at a time, about childhood and adolescence and the things that might be relevant to both your spiritual journey and the journey of acceptance as far as your sexual orientation and your decisions about relationships. So I'm sure that there may or may not be important foundational issues of your childhood. But Tanya, maybe you could just tell us just a little bit about your early years and what your family was like, what your religious experience was like, both as a child and then maybe get into your adolescence.
Mm-hmm. Well, all four of my grandparents were deacons in the church. That means something a little different than it does in LDS terms. It means kind of elders in the church or leaders in the church. And so
Can I stop you a second? You said it's like Mennonite. Now, I think of Mennonite as being a highly conservative religion. They're mm-hmm. sort of the not quite so extreme Amish religion. Is mm-hmm. Am I getting the idea that your religion was also a very fundamentalist religion?
Well, you know, that's a really interesting question because like Mennonites. There are the Amish are the extremely fundamentalist sect, or kind of a break off that's very traditional, and they wear plain clothes and things like that. There's a similar thing in the Church of the Brethren, where there are folks that do that. Now, my ancestors were a little bit more progressive, so I never wore different clothing or anything like that. But there is also an incredibly liberal part of the church. Regions of North America in particular might have different political or even interpretations of the religion. Uh-huh. So it's very diverse. And so you might have some very fundamentalist folks, and then you might have the people that are peace activists or involved in social justice work who are much more liberal. So what's beautiful actually about the religion is that you can interpret it very broadly. Sometimes you can even, sit at the same table, because there's so much a commitment to nonviolent communication and mediation work. You can have very different perspectives and you still be under the same umbrella of the faith or the religion. So I would say that my family was kind of more towards the conservative side, although not as conservative as the Amish. So hopefully right. That helps a little bit.
And is this a large community, or is this a small minority in the communities where you live, or are they sort of congregated in tell me the name again of the
Church of the Brethren. Where I grew up in Ohio, it was fairly common to see them. They're common in Pennsylvania, Ohio, Indiana, and certainly other places as well. But I would still say we were a minority. It's certainly nothing like, say, Utah, where a very large percentage of people all have the same religion. Where I grew up, I would say there were, maybe 5% were members of the Church of the Brethren in the area I was raised in, but there were a lot of Protestants around, so I didn't feel that very different than other people that where I was growing up.
As part of that religion, did you feel like you were a mainstream Protestant, or did you feel like you were really a part, or that you were a sort of a chosen people in the way the Mormons do, or do you feel like you were just one of many acceptable Protestant religions?
I felt a little bit different than Protestants, and there were a couple of differences in how we were Protestants, but I think I didn't feel the same way, like set apart as a people, that the same way that I've observed in the LDS community. So I think it is a little different. There was more of an openness. There wasn't the one and only true church sort of feeling. There was room to see that others' interpretations and our interpretations were different, but I don't know that there was such a staunch belief that any one church was right over another, at least not in my experience growing up.
Okay. Well, then let's go back then. You were just telling me that all four of your grandparents were in the religion. Mm-hmm. Why don't you continue with that sort of family background?
Yeah, my parents met, I think, at a church social event for young people. There was always that sort of an element. I don't know that I would say that my parents were certainly religious to a certain degree, but I wouldn't say that it permeated every aspect of our life always. I mean, we waxed and waned a little bit with being super involved in church, with times where we were a little bit less involved. But one thing that does kind of stand out to me in my growing up time was when I was in the Anabaptist traditions, you choose when it's time to be baptized, or you feel there's an altar call, or there's a moment where you feel moved by the Spirit that, yes, I do profess that this is true, and you have a testimony at that moment, and you go forward at the end of a church service or when you're moved to do this, and you, quote-unquote, accept Christ into your life. And I remember being in Sunday school, kind of had a lot of questions, and I always had kind of intellectual questions about what I was learning about. And a lot of my peers, were baptized, accepted Christ, or were baptized before me. I think I was one of the last ones of my peer group, because I had so many questions. I had doubts. I had, things that didn't quite make sense to me yet. And I do remember one service that particularly moved me. It was all about serving and how serving with love and serving others is really at the core of what it means to be Christian. And I'm like, well, yeah, that's something I can, I believe in very much. I feel very passionate about that. And so that was what kind of spoke to me in a profound way. And I felt, okay, if this is what it means to be Christian, that's what I want to be. That's what I want to do in the world and be in the world is someone who's of service to others. And so I felt I didn't have all the answers to all my questions, but I felt that I could say yes to that and very strongly. So I did get baptized. I think I was 12 or 13. I think maybe I was 12, almost to turn 13 or somewhere in that range. But interestingly, at the very same time, it was 1983-84, when the Church of the Brethren and the Mennonite Church, both of those churches were struggling with the wording of the Statement of Faith. And they added at that time language to the Statement of Faith that said that it was incompatible with Christianity to be homosexual. So that marriage was between a man and a woman, and that if you were a homosexual, that you had to be celibate, you couldn't be in a relationship, any kind of homosexual relations or relationship is incompatible with Christianity. And I remember that stood out to me at the time. I didn't realize when I was 12 or 13 that I was gay necessarily. I hadn't figured that out yet, but I remember feeling really impacted by the discussions that were going on at that time, which some seemed pretty hateful and kind of scary. I remember thinking to myself, wow, I don't really know anyone who's gay because there's nobody that awful. I don't know anybody that sinister or that evil in my life. They must not live in my town. And but at the same time, I had this kind of...
But you certainly weren't identifying with that yourself.
No, I had this sick feeling in my gut, though, that something was wrong. You know, I didn't... You know, something wasn't adding up and that something felt very confusing to me at that time. So later, as I went into my teen years, I don't think I really fell in love with a woman until I was in my undergraduate degree. So I was off at college and then I had to really struggle with it. But it was certainly it was challenging to kind of. I just joined the church, and then the church kind of said that being gay was against the Statement of Faith. So it was just an unusual coincidence, I suppose.
So how old were you then when you ended up joining?
When I joined, I was 12 to 13, somewhere in that range. I think I was almost 13. So
is that when you also woke up to the fact that you might be lesbian or...
Well, I think I didn't want to admit that to myself, but certainly I had crushes. I wouldn't have labeled them as such, but it wasn't, like I said, it wasn't until I was 19, where I actually fell in love with someone. And that became, I kind of felt split. The half of me was the good Tanya that was raised in the church and, you know, was doing this and this and this and this. And then there was this other Tanya who was in love with this person who seemed very Christ-like, who was very caring, very service-oriented, the kind of Christian you're supposed to want to partner up with and be married to, you know, a very genuine and warm person. But there were two of me, you know, and I couldn't reconcile that. I lived probably a year and a half, almost 2 years in a relationship with this woman, and I couldn't. It was like there were two of me. There was the me that was with her in private, and then there was the me that was the public me that still attended church and still, you know. And so I did have this double self that I couldn't reconcile even within my own self at all. I couldn't admit one half of myself to the other for a period of time. And I had to stop going to church and eventually speak with a Christian counselor who was a very liberal person that helped me start to sort that out and reconcile some of that. But I think it probably took me until I was in my mid-30s to finish that work, if I'm totally finished.
Okay, but you entered your first relationship around age 19.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so at some point, I mean, at that point, were you saying, at least in the context of the relationship, you were identifying yourself as a lesbian?
No, actually, I was so conflicted that I actually didn't admit that I was a lesbian until that relationship ended. So I was probably almost 21 when I finally admitted it to myself and maybe, you know, came out to a few people. So, yeah, I was pretty conflicted over the church and lesbian issue.
Okay, so would you say that this messages of shame about lesbianism were certainly being ingrained to you as part of your religious experience throughout your adolescence?
Definitely.
And in your community, there really wasn't any identifiably gay people. There was no one you actually knew who was openly gay or lesbian.
No, there really wasn't anyone that was openly gay or lesbian. There were certainly people that, you know, there were a few female coaches at the school that people suspected were lesbian and that sort of thing. So there were rumors about that sort of thing. But yeah, I think the first person that I knew for certain was lesbian was someone I had met about the time that it was in college for sure. So,
okay. And would you say that you were drawn towards any things that might be considered stereotypical, like more interested in sports or?
No, I really can't play softball.
But how about just the experience of dating guys? Was this part of your adolescence too? Did you feel sort of pressure to have boyfriends? Was that sort of the normal thing for a 16-year-old or an 18-year-old in your community, in your at least religious community?
Well, I was very involved in music at my school, and I was there was a young man in the band that I played in that apparently noticed me. I really didn't even know he existed until he asked me out, and I'm like, well, that's interesting. He seems like a nice person. I guess I'll go out. And we ended up dating for a little over a year. But that really ended because I was really not able to reciprocate how he was feeling about me. We were great friends and we had wonderful intellectual conversations and we had fun together. But he was really interested in it moving beyond a friendship relationship, and because I wasn't able to do that, we broke up. So, but it was a great cover for a year or so when I was feeling like, oh, I really should be dating and I should be interested and I'm not. And well, I guess, you know, it seemed a reasonable compromise because he was a nice person and a good friend, and probably was not as good a situation for him as it was for me, I suppose.
but meanwhile, you said you were having teen crushes on different peers, different friends, but it just, was it a distracting sort of crush, or was it just a, how did you put that, or what did you do with that?
I really wasn't admitting that to myself. I didn't label that as a crush at all. I just couldn't go there. I suppose I was in denial about that at that point. But, you know, when I was off at school, when I was doing my undergrad, it was different because I wasn't immersed in the same community. My parents weren't right there kind of, you know, overseeing my development any longer in a more immediate way. And so I had more.
And you had grown up in a small town.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So when you went to college, was it in a bigger, was it a big school?
It was a mid-sized state university. So. But I had a lot more freedom there to sort out the pieces of what was expected of me by others and what I really felt was right for me.
Okay. So that's where you entered that relationship that, you know, you were both college students.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. But you guys hung in there together a couple of years, even though you weren't necessarily defining it as a lesbian relationship. That's
yes.
what it was.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay. Well, since I got you basically to adulthood, I'm going to maybe switch over to Karen and have her get us this far. I think that, Tanya, your story, even though it wasn't Mormon, it wasn't vastly different from a typical Mormon's upbringing. So. Now I'd like to hear about Karen's background and early years.
I grew up youngest of seven in a family that was extremely devout in the church, actually still is extremely devout and active. The church was everything to us. It was what guided us. It was how we decided what we would do. Our activities were geared around that, and we were very, very happy with that in a general way. I mean, overall, it was a lovely family situation, and it meant everything in the world to me to be loved and accepted by my family. And being the youngest, I had four brothers and two sisters, and I just wanted them to love me and to be involved with everything they were involved in. At the same time, having four older brothers, I used to always tell my mom, "Mom, I wish I was a boy." And she would sit me down and say, "Now, Karen, I prayed for a girl, and you were my answer to prayer." So, of course, with that, I was determined to be the best little girl I could be. She'd give me dolls for Christmas, and I would just be devastated because I never wanted a doll for Christmas. And so I think from that point, I mean, I was always labeled a tomboy. There were several times when people who didn't know me would call me a boy. To a certain extent, that bothered me, but it bothered me more because I didn't quite know what my identity was. I don't feel, you know, that I'm in any way transgender. I really do feel that I am a lesbian woman, but I didn't have a name for any of that. I just knew that I wanted a pocket knife and I wanted to wear jeans and I hated dresses. And so, but I just kind of worked through that feeling very awkward as I would go to church in my dress and my mom would tell me to, you know, put my legs together and cross my legs. And, you know, I had to be taught all of these things because
they didn't come naturally.
Yeah, they didn't come naturally to me at all. I wanted to be out studying bugs and just playing in the dirt and building things and whittling with wood, you know. So time went on, and partly because the church was so important to my family and partly because I was such a spiritual child, I turned to the church to guide me and to really be my structure, my scaffold for life and for spirituality. And I was a very prayerful child and really, really always concerned about doing what was right. And so when I first heard about gay people, I think it was, you know, I think it was maybe through the media, through Three's Company, you know. And so they were these really funny men, you know, that's all I knew, that they were these really funny men who acted a little bit like women. You know, that was my stereotype of what I saw. And then, of course, what I learned from the church was that these people were evil and dirty and filthy. And similar to what Tanya said, I thought, well, certainly that's not me. So as I developed, got a little older, and started to have my first crushes, maybe at age 12, 13, similar to Tanya, I didn't call them that. I just called them extremely close friendships. And by the time I was 17, I was physically intimate with another young woman. And now here the Mormon in me comes out and says, "Now, we didn't go all the way." You know, I feel I have to qualify that for the audience. Isn't that funny?
Well, I'm glad you did. It's partly to give us a perspective on what was going on in your head.
Yeah, that's true. And really to have an understanding of that, the moment I realized that I had feelings that might go to the point that I would not be temple worthy, I immediately went to the bishop, you know, because as soon as I realized that these weren't just, this is a best friend that I can't stop thinking about, because that was okay. But as soon as it was, I want to kiss this person or, you know, et cetera, then I realized that these were the kinds of things that I was learning about in mutual that I wasn't supposed to do, that were called not right and evil. And so I immediately, without hesitation, went to the bishop and said, "Okay, here's what I've got going on." And the bishop very gently and kindly suggested that this was a special love from God that I had with this friend, and we just needed to set up some strict rules and guidelines for ourselves. And so this friend and I did. We talked through it and got...
Oh, that's interesting. So your bishop didn't give you a message that this was wrong and you shouldn't ever talk to her again or anything like that?
No.
Your bishop kind of thought that you could turn it in, contain it in set of boundaries, and it could still be a positive thing.
Right. So in other words, I wasn't being told, you are a lesbian, you need to fix this. I was being told, oh, sometimes we have special close friendships, and that's okay as long as you don't do these certain things. And I think it might be different for lesbians than for my gay brothers in the church. And I mean brothers in a general sense there, because... yeah, I'm the only out gay person in my family. But anyway, I think it's a little different for lesbians because there's this gray line. You just can't look at someone, perhaps, who's a petite, small, white female looking at you. You know, I've been told so many times, your look is the epitome of innocence in this culture.
Okay.
You know, and I don't know if that's fair, but I just think... someone looks at you and says, oh, well, certainly you can't be one of those people. You know what I'm saying? And yeah. So perhaps he didn't want to believe that he'd have to go through this route with me either. And I know that's not fair because I think we all come with a level playing field. But somehow I was able to give that innocent look, perhaps, and... be believed in a way that he would just say, this is a special love from God, be friends. Or maybe that's how I interpret it. Maybe he didn't want to get into it.
Or maybe he was just particularly compassionate and, or maybe his gut reaction wasn't set off by the thought of you kissing this girl. I mean, you know, there's lots of things, I mean, that happen that people, you know, bishops have gut reactions, and maybe if they're their internalized homophobia might not be as set off by the thought of these young girls, you know, not going all the way, which you already specified.
You know what's interesting to me, Daniel, as I talk to you about this, this isn't one bishop. This is a composite of bishops that I talk to throughout my life.
Okay.
And so we could say this is one person, but really, I guess maybe I would come to them and say, I have a spiritual intimacy with this young woman or with this woman later on. And that's what it always was to me first. It was never, holy cow, I just have to be intimate with this person. You know, it was not that as much as I love this person so much and I want to always be with this person. And I want to express my affection for this person in every single possible way that I can. And so maybe recognizing that first as a spiritual relationship, you know, what do you say? I don't know. But in any case...
Well, when I was young, my entire family sat down and watched Anne of Green Gables. And in that show, you know, Anne has this passionate romance with her friend Diana. And they even give each other a kiss. And nobody was bothered by this.
Right.
Nobody. I mean, maybe that's where they were at, you know.
Well, and I think Tanya might be able to jump in here. You know, just the way our culture sees intimate women versus the way our culture sees intimate men.
Right.
And so you don't notice lesbians the same way you notice gay men.
I'd love to throw something in. Actually, Karen and I were in Temple Square once, and this was before Karen had come out to me, but I was pretty clear that Karen had feelings for me, and we were walking through Temple Square, and Karen grabbed my arm, and I was immediately looking around going, oh my gosh, I'm going to get gay bashed. You know, like, who's going to see this? And Karen's like, oh no, no. You know, she was literally thinking that, yeah, women can, you know, walk arm in arm in Temple Square and no one's going to think that they're lesbian. But you know, I've been, so many people have called me sir in my life that for me, I was immediately fearful, like, oh no, someone's going to think, you know, so we had very different reactions to that. But I do think that, like Karen was saying, you know, the idea of two women snuggling on the couch together is a very different thing if two men were snuggling on the couch together. You know, I think there's definitely a different social way of looking at that. And so I think that could be what's at play in this reaction from the bishop.
No, and I'm sure that is. And I'm thinking back to some of my friends in college, and I belong to this gang of people. We were actually working Pioneer Trek together, and all the women in the group were super affectionate. Well, we were all affectionate with each other, but they were particularly affectionate. You know, they would, you know, lie in bed together, have these long talks deep into the night kind of thing, and give each other, you know, scalp massages and do all these sort of affectionate things that nobody thought anything of beyond just that it was, you know, genuine friendship. So, yeah, I guess I'm not surprised, you know, now that I think about it, although I hadn't really stopped to think about that.
Yeah, so that does, I think that's probably the reason.
Yeah, and, but can I,
oh, go
can
ahead.
I just bring up with you, Karen, though, were you, you know, a lot, so many Mormon women talk about the shaming messages they do get about chastity and as adolescents. I mean, is there, would you say that this, that meanwhile was impacting you, these other kind of messages that are sort of notorious in that era in Mormonism?
Sure, absolutely. I think I would first say that I was pretty much blinding myself to the so-called same-sex attraction and just seeing it perhaps more as maybe that I had some overly deep or overly intimate connections with other women that I'd even possibly call dysfunctional at times because I didn't understand how different I was from my friends.
Right.
Regarding the shaming messages, first of all, I was still perceiving myself as a straight person who just needed to learn how to like boys, if that makes sense. Yep. And if, you know, we've heard this a thousand times, but if I just spend enough time with them, I'll gradually get accustomed to the way they smell, et cetera, you know. which, of course, now I realize is absolute silliness. But, you know, but if I just practice this enough, it will get easy for me. And, of course, I was practicing that for 22 years from age 17 to age 39, just saying, just enough practice, and I'll get this. And it never quite happened. So in one way, I was thinking, wow, I'm keeping all of the law of chastity extremely well because I am really not tempted to do anything with guys.
Okay.
And so I was kind of proud of myself for, you know, not having these feelings that are, you know, so strong and, you know, so in a way, yay, I'm doing okay that way. I can live the law of chastity. But at the same time, I was covering to the point of some real self-loathing. I was covering up these feelings that I had for women and shaming myself tremendously. I mean, to the point of making myself physically ill because I was so tense, I was so uptight, and trying so hard to convince myself in my head that one way was right when really I knew it wasn't. And really, I spent a long time being physically ill and unhealthy and in tremendous pain in my legs and, you know, just in my body in general because I was so literally uptight, trying to hold in my feelings and not feel what was naturally being felt.
So, well, let's kind of go back and make sure we've tied up your adolescence. Is there, you finished high school, everything was okay at school. I mean, was it basically a positive experience? You're, you know, growing up in Logan, Utah.
Oh my gosh, yes. Yes. Oh, I loved it. I mean, it was okay. Fantastic. I didn't date much at all. I mean, I'd try, maybe I'd go to homecoming with someone or, you know, and I would maybe go on two dates a year just because I wanted to socially fit in. And so, you know, dances, really that's about the only dating I did was dances.
Okay.
And of course I hated to dance. It was never natural ever until I met Tanya and just found my feet just moving when I was in her arms, but we're not there yet. But anyway, I was doing these unnatural things, trying to fit in, but I loved high school. I mean, it was a great situation, but I really focused on music, and we had a fantastic music program at my high school, so I was involved with that, and just...
Were you in the choir or the band?
I was in the orchestra. I'm a cellist, and actually played in high school orchestra and 1 year in Mormon Youth Symphony, and my dad drove me down every Tuesday night to rehearsals for that, so I was extremely serious about the cello, and I think the cello saved my life, literally, because I had somewhere to put my energy and my feelings and my emotions in a place that was safe. And so all of this conflict inside of me could go into some really intense concertos, you know? And so basically I was inseparable from my cello. But yeah, it was a fantastic high school experience overall. And I loved Mutual. I was extremely active in that and always saw myself being a member of the church and even thinking of great leadership opportunities that I might have in the future, you know, which I think I'm realizing is very Mormon thing to aspire to some of these callings that you're not supposed to aspire to.
Right.
So.
Well, so where'd you go to college then?
I was in Arizona for 3 years and then went to the Oberlin Conservatory of Music, where I completed a performance degree in cello.
Okay. Oberlin is in, where's that?
Ohio, near Cleveland.
Okay. So you started out, so you left Logan and went down to Arizona?
Yes.
How come?
Well, there was a cellist there who was internationally renowned, and my teacher I was studying with recommended that I look into him, and they gave me a nice scholarship and seemed like a place to go that was away from Utah. I did want to get out of Utah, but it was less to do with Mormonism and more to do with seeing the world and growing.
Okay, well, you know, I guess for now I'll just continue with you, Karen, and just tell me what happened with the first part of your adult life?
I tried just about everything to overcome my same-sex attraction. By the time I was in college, it was clear to me that this was something that I would label same-sex attraction. And I had a friend there, and we became quite intimate would cuddle a lot. And her mom even asked us, are you two lesbians? And we were both like, oh, of course not. We just love each other a whole lot, you know? And okay. So I was still doing that. But in the back of my mind at this point, I knew that there was definitely an attraction there. And at that point, I started looking for anything in my past that might have discouraged me from being with men, you know, any childhood abuse that I had experienced by neighborhood boys or anything, you know, and started really claiming that as, well, I was abused in this situation, and so I am, you know, I don't have attraction for men because of this, you know. And so I started going down the I was abused excuse, if you will, and which, you know, I own that a lot of people are abused, but I know a lot of people who were sexually abused who are extremely straight, and right. And I know a lot of lesbians who were never abused. And so, you know, I see that now as an excuse that we hold on to just to find anything so we can stay with the beliefs that we have. And so I tried that for a lot of years and just held on to that. And if I just try this approach, and ended up doing some things that, you know, were hurtful just because I was not being true to myself. I was trying to stifle all of the feelings I had for women around me, trying to force myself to have feelings for any man who would pay attention to me. And it just never worked. And I just
Did you do a psychotherapy, reparative therapy? Did you?
I did psychotherapy. I did a lot of talk therapy. I never did any of the really horrible stuff that some of my gay brothers and sisters have gone through. But I did do it to myself, Daniel. I will say that. I abused myself emotionally and was on such a strict regime for myself that I wouldn't allow myself to feel a lot of feelings, let alone do anything, you know, and I wouldn't drink Diet Coke, or I wouldn't watch rated PG-13 movies because I was trying so hard to be turbo righteous, you know?
Okay.
And so I was really uptight, I guess is the best way to say it. And just,
was this interfering with your capacity to have friendships?
Yes.
Were you scared to have a friendship with a woman because you were getting too much intense feelings, so you would avoid them? Or?
Oh, yeah. And it was interfering with my capacity to do everything. It interfered with my capacity to play the cello, because if I would relax enough to have a good tone on the cello, then I would relax enough to feel anything. And I don't know if that makes sense, but I was literally keeping myself from feeling anything at all most of the time, except perhaps happiness and joy. When I was perhaps, you know, I ended up being a music teacher, and I would feel joy and be able to give outward to my students, but not be able to care for myself or feel my own emotions, if that makes sense.
Okay. So from Oberlin, you went in the direction of music education.
I did. Okay. I attribute it to this, but I had tremendous performance anxiety. And I realized this very strongly when I was at Oberlin, that every time I got on a stage, I had to be vulnerable. Uh-huh. And the moment I was vulnerable, I was kind of realizing, you know, here I was and the real me, and I had to shut it back up. And so I was living in tension. And so with that performance anxiety, and at the same time realizing that I may not ever get married, I realized that I really loved teaching. And so I switched gears and went into teaching, and oh, what a joy. I mean, just the best 13 years of my career, not of my life, because that comes later. but the best professional job I ever could have had, just giving, okay, giving, loving, serving these students, yeah, every day, and working in music.
In the public schools.
Yeah.
Okay. So, but let me go back a little bit then. So when you were actually at Oberlin, I mean, I assume you were doing the singles wards scene, you were an active warman, but at some point it sunk in that you just weren't going to get married.
I always had hopes, you know, I always, and you know, I had these images in my head that were really ridiculous. But I had these dreams that somehow it would work and I would find a way. But I think at the same time, my instincts, my gut were saying, you need to move on with a life as if you were going to be single the rest of your life.
Uh-huh.
You know, so again, kind of like Tanya said, I had these two me's, and one was really trying everything possible and believing everything I was told by church leaders to do to get over this. And then the other part of me that was realizing what I really wanted and needed. So these two parts of me that were dueling, if you will. So I kind of just felt like, and it just felt in general, professionally too, that I would be so much happier as a teacher.
Yeah. So you finished at Oberlin and you went directly into teaching from there.
I did. Yeah.
And where did you do that?
5 years in rural Idaho, in the Rupert area. And then went back to Logan and actually taught 8 years at the high school that I went to.
Oh, okay. Okay. So should we just continue with you, Karen, until the point where you meet Tanya, and then we'll catch Tanya up to the point where she met you, and then we'll go on together after that?
Sure.
Okay. So why don't you keep going, Karen?
It's really, you know, as a school teacher, I guess I could really cap from the time I left high school, or I guess really from Oberlin until I started a PhD program, that I was just in this big place of denial. That was the darkest, lowest point of my life. I was suicidal. I was really running from myself. But at the same time, when I would go to work, I would be so happy and so full of energy with these kids. And I've heard about people who are comedians who actually have depression. And that's kind of how I was, is I would walk in the door, and the moment I would step on the orchestra podium, I would become a different person. And and I could just go into this person and just be loving and magnanimous and give and feel and breathe music and breathe love. And then as soon as I'd go home, depression would hit. And I would, because I'd have to face myself. And so I would, I developed workaholism and would literally keep myself so busy so I would never have to look myself in the mirror. And, you know, sometimes I'd wake up at 2 a.m. and just feel suicidal, you know, and that was the only time I'd allow myself to feel anything. And then I'd basically turn it off, as the song says from Book of Mormon musical. I would turn it off and go back to work and be happy and full of life and energy. And then I'd go home and just fall apart. And so that, that was kind
of... Were you getting any spiritual enrichment through church or?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. But at the same time, as I would do that, I would feel the spirit. I would be full of this joy and energy. And as soon as I would go home, I would start beating myself up over it, you know, and just saying, well, you've got to stay righteous. You've got to do this. And so, yeah, I mean, there was a lot of fulfillment, you know, and again, even in church, I served in that period as basically in almost every capacity a woman can serve in at the ward level. So I was a primary teacher, primary president, counselor, chorister, was in young women president, but that wasn't until I met Tanya, you know, relief society president and singles ward. So I was extremely busy in the church, which kept me, you know, again, helped me with that workaholism and that, you know, if I just force this enough, if I'm just righteous enough, if I just believe in Christ enough, you know, the same story. I don't know how many times we've heard this from gay people who just want to make it work. You know, if I just work hard enough, this will all be different.
Which is what we're taught.
Yeah, sure. By well-meaning people, incidentally, who really were taught that by someone else who really loved them, you know, and and I own that. And as a young woman president, I was telling my youth the same thing. You know, I mean, I remember one time standing up and telling the youth that homosexuality and murder were pretty much the same thing. You know, I mean, because I had been told that, and that was the message I had to pass on. Because otherwise I might fall apart and admit that I was gay, you know? So sure, you know, and I still think about that and hope that somehow being true to myself now and showing people how happy I am now can free that, that lie.
So you, so at some point you decided to end your teaching career and go back and get your PhD? Is that what I...
I did. I went to BYU and worked on a master's and had a professor there who encouraged me to go and get a PhD. And I said, no, I can't do that. I don't want to leave my students. And he said, no, you really would do well to get a PhD and become a college professor. And so I took him seriously and thought, well, I'll just take off 1 year, go on sabbatical and start a PhD and see what it's like. And so I started that program, and dun-da-da-dum, I meet Tanya.
Okay, so where did you go to that program then?
University of Illinois.
University of Illinois, which is in the Quad Cities, is that right?
Champaign-Urbana.
Okay, yeah. So, well, then that's obviously a big event, but let me, let's move over and bring Tanya's story up to date, because she left us just sort of as a struggling college student was trying to manage putting in perspective this relationship she just got out of. And so what it, you go from there, Tanya, and what your journey was.
Well, I, during that time in undergrad, I had a year or at least one semester. I mean, I was a good student and doing well. And then I pretty much got so depressed and so upset, I almost failed an entire semester. So I ended up being in undergrad for an extra year because I wanted to make up for that semester. It was important for me. But I remember...
What did you... Excuse me. What did you study?
I was also in music education. So
Okay.
Interestingly, I took some art classes that I weren't part of my curriculum at that time. I think I did that to preserve myself. It gave me an outlet. So some of the courses I failed weren't essential for my degree, fortunately. But I couldn't show up to class. I would be up till 4 or 5 o'clock at night, worrying, trying to sort things out, trying to figure out how I was going to put all of my pieces back together, how I would be able to move forward, how could I be a music teacher if I was gay and I would have to be in the closet and maybe I would get, you know, maybe that would be a problem for me and maybe I wouldn't be able to be on my own. I mean, I had all these questions, all these doubts, and so I couldn't sleep at night, and then when I finally did get to sleep, you know, I couldn't get to class. I remember there was only one thing I could do. I was in a leadership position with the marching band, and I was leading a section leader, and I had a responsibility to teach others, and so I did get up. That was at 4 in the afternoon, and I made sure I was there for that because I had some responsibility to others, and that kind of kept me going during that time. But I got to the point where at the very end of undergrad, I was seeing a counselor that was starting to help me a little bit. And I was with a group of other like-minded people with similar issues. So she put us together in a counseling group that was starting to help me a little bit because it was within a spiritual context. So she was helping us to open our minds a little bit to broader interpretations and in a nutshell, she was trying to invite us to consider that the divine was larger than we thought. And so that was, that kind of opened a small little crack in a window for me. But I remember still being very full of self-doubt, self-loathing. And I remember coming to my senior recital. Every music major has to do a recital before they graduate to demonstrate proficiency on their instrument.
What's your instrument?
French horn. And I got to that point, and I did not want to do my recital because I knew if I stood in front of an audience and I played my instrument, that even though I could play and play well, I knew that something in my tone, something in the expression of what I was playing would expose my insides to my audience. I felt vulnerable as if I were naked. My soul was would be, you know, naked in front of an entire room. And everyone would be able to see or hear or feel or sense how in pain I was. And so I really struggled with that sort of expression. I think that relates to what Karen was saying about her performance anxiety.
Yeah.
And I made myself do it so I could graduate. It was a horrible experience. And I didn't play my instrument for 12 years after that. It was devastating to me because that was so important to me up to that point. But it was an awful experience that I made myself do. And I went and I got a teaching position at a small school, and I became a workaholic, just like Karen. I think it's an occupational hazard of music education, but it was convenient for both of us, I think. It's really easy to overwork there and I had a job where it was easy to do that anyway, but it was lovely. But I did come out to my parents after I think it was October. I started teaching in August, of course, and I made a trip back to Ohio, to tell my parents, and that was pretty awful.
But at that point, you'd only had that one relationship, but you weren't actually pursuing relationships. You were basically...
Well, actually, I was during that time, I think it was middle of undergrad where I broke up with the first partner, and then, you know, shortly thereafter, there was, you know, I started dating another person, and by the time I finished undergrad, I was in a relationship with that person, so...
Okay.
So yeah, I needed to come out, but I wanted to have a job. I wanted to be able to support myself before I, you know, told my parents. And it was really awful at first. My mother definitely thought I was going to hell. So she was really upset. And I was so young, I wasn't mature enough to handle some of that conflict very well. So I admit right now that I didn't handle that situation like I certainly could have later in my life when I knew myself better, but it was what it was. But you know, all is well though. A decade or so later, we were able to work through a lot of that, but
this put a big schism, at least that lasted quite a while.
Yeah, it was difficult. It made relating to family very difficult. And
did you sort of manage to separate from the church by then? Or were you still involved in the same religious community?
I stopped going to church about the same time that I got, my first partner, or first girlfriend, the one I spoke about before, she knew that religion was very important to me, and she even joined the church during that time as a way to try to connect with me spiritually, but I wasn't able to connect with her because I was so conflicted. So I was still attending church somewhat during that period, but when I broke up with her, I knew that I was in too much conflict, and I needed to start sorting that out. And the counselor that I went to, it was a Christian ministries group, which was interdenominational, and she did counseling through that center, and she did really help me to open up to the possibility that the God loved every person that God had created. So I don't know that I believed her, but I kind of hung on to that for a while and hoped that maybe that was true. I kind of thought, well, if Christianity is such that God created me for the purpose of condemning me to hell, like, is there really, do other people in other religions believe that? You know, that the creator would just, and I, do people do that? Do people create things just to break them and destroy them? Like, I couldn't relate to that. That didn't make any sense to me. So I looked at Buddhism, and I started reading Joseph Campbell and his comparative religious studies, and just started diving in, learning more about other cultures and religion. And I didn't really see that anywhere else. I saw certainly there were cultures and there were groups of people that were not accepting of gay persons, but I didn't ever see this kind of the same structure set up. I kind of walked away at that point, and I tried to convince myself that I wasn't spiritual because it was just easier if I could just wall that off and kind of pretend that didn't exist. So I kind of did the opposite of what Karen did. Karen kind of tried to maintain her spiritual community and her relating to the church and not explore sexuality, whereas I allowed myself to explore my sexuality and just kind of walled myself off from the church community for a number of years. And it wasn't until I was kind of in a midlife crisis situation about when I was in my mid-30s before I started reconciling my spiritual self with the rest of me.
And that's what you're describing. Well, both of you are describing common things that, and I guess I'd have to say that there's a lot of people who kind of do one or the other, where they just kind of say, well, the spirituality wasn't working, so I'm just going to set it aside and because I have to go on with life and shelf it. So I've talked to a lot of people who describe what Karen describes, but I've also talked to and know a lot of people, including myself, you might say, that weren't with that track or of setting it aside.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so were you still, though, you went on and became a music educator. Were you still working nearby your family? Did you kind of stay in your home?
No.
For a while?
My partner at the time that I graduated was going to Illinois for school, and so I looked for a position in Illinois, and I found a teaching position, and I taught in the public schools for a number of years and then did other community-based music education work after that. Then after my second partner and I broke up, I ended up meeting someone else. I helped parent her child for 11 years, and so I had an opportunity to be a parent.
So you had an experience raising a child for 11 years with a partner?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, she was the little girl was 3 and a half when I met her, and I was in a relationship with her and her mother until she was about 14.
So keep going then. How did things evolve from there?
Well, that relationship was not particularly a very functional one. And I stayed in it probably longer than was healthy for me. Well, I know that that's true. And I kind of came to kind of midlife, and I'm like, there's got to be more than this. And whatever I'm doing right now is really not working for me. And so I did. I had kind of a midlife crisis. I was going back to school because my career trajectory wasn't exactly, you know, where I wanted it to be either. So I was starting to make some changes in my life, and that kind of propelled me into a period of crisis and immense change. And I would say that that's when I kind of walled off this spiritual Tanya that it was the Tanya that I kind of knew growing up, And I explored my sexuality and the other side of me. And I, when I got to that point in midlife, I'm like, okay, I need all of me to go forward from this point. And I've got to put this back together. And so I got into therapy. And fortunately, I was, I didn't know this at the time, but I went to a therapist who happened to be an ordained minister. And she happened to be an ordained minister in the Mennonite Church. And that's just so similar. The Mennonite Church and the Brethren Church are so very similar. There's just a few things that are different between the two of them. And it was the perfect thing for me. And I do believe that the divine kind of put her in my path because I worked with her a lot. And she really helped me to reconcile things in a healthy way that I could put all my pieces back together and go forward from that, that as a whole being as much as I've been able to at this point. Anyway, I think that's a lifelong process for all of us to some degree, but I really had to put that back together. So I started attending a progressive Mennonite church where there were lots of, I would say it was the particular congregation I went to. There were lots of very educated people there. Many, they were university professors. It ranged the gamut. There were very conservative people there too, but everyone worked really well together, and community is very important in the Mennonite church. So I felt very welcomed there. And it was a wonderful safe space for me to start integrating what I had learned from other religions and putting it back together in Christian terminology and to go, oh, wait, so this really means that. And, oh, this means this. And, oh, I understand this from this experience. And I started putting those things back together. And it was a very wonderful healing process. It took a few years.
Just a sec. So you, but you, even though you're away from spirituality, you did get some information about Buddhism and other religions. Just you, so you must have had some sort of interest in it, even though it was.
Oh yes, it was a completely intellectual pursuit, though it wasn't a spiritual pursuit. And I attended a UU church, which was lovely because you can do intellectual pursuits very easily in that community. And that was a wonderful place for me. It was a good transition space for me.
Universalist Unitarian.
Unitarian Universalist, yeah.
Unitarian Universalist.
Yes. And that was good because I could learn about lots of different traditions and I could, you know. So, yeah, it was always there in the background, but it was always an intellectual pursuit. You know, I don't know that I was, I never had a practice per se. So I stopped going to the Unitarian Church, and I eventually did attend the Mennonite Church for a few years as I was
now in this Mennonite Church. Were you able to be openly lesbian, or was it progressive enough that you didn't have to hide yourself?
Well, I was completely out to the ministers, the pastors at the church right from the very beginning. I wasn't overly out to the congregation. I was, you know, kind of, because I could tell that there were some conservative people there. There were some progressive people. So as I got to know people, it would come out in conversation in a natural way. And that I felt very comfortable with that. I would say a large number of the people there were very supportive of me. There were probably some people there that had a hard time later when I announced that Karen and I were getting married. I think there were some people that struggled with that at that point. Maybe they were in denial. They liked who I was and what I stood for, but they didn't really believe I was gay or something.
Or thought you might remain celibate.
Perhaps that. So, like I said, there's a wide range of people in different perspectives or different interpretations within the umbrella of that particular religion. So I, of course, related to some of the more progressive people that attended there. And there were a few people there that were even what they... one person said, I'm a defector in place. So someone who really had serious doubts about some of the dogma of the church, but believed in the community and believed in the service and really were wonderful people that I really related to quite a lot. So,
okay. So does that bring us almost to the point where we're each caught up to more or less the same time frame?
Yeah,
I think so, because it was shortly after or during that period of time that I met Karen. So,
thank you for joining us today on Gay Mormon Stories. To discuss this episode with others, please check us out at gaymormonstories.org. If you want to see this podcast continue, please consider making a monthly donation, again at gaymormonstories.org. All donations go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer Mormons. Music for this podcast was donated by George Parkinson and Kelly Clark Parkinson.
Thou didst them unto.